actually built up from smaller systems. We have a basic model that seems to fit a lot of the large-scale structure data that sort of serves as an input for most of our pictures of structure information, and that's a model in which most of the universe, well, most of the energy density of the universe is actually in the form of a vacuum energy. That's nice. That's 70%. The next 28% is in the form of cold dark matter, supersymmetric dark matter or axions, something of that sort. And the remaining 2% is in the form of baryonic matter, and of which we only see 0.5%. And absolutely. And you know, when we look at galaxies, we seem to be seeing this process of when people first talked about galaxy formation, I think the original sort of language people spoke of was galaxy formation was an event that happened at redshift 5. And that was sort of, I think, the right picture if you really had kind of a top-down scenario where one big overdensity collapsed. But the picture we now have is galaxy formation is a process. It's an ongoing process. And that you continue to accrete new satellites. Within a billion years, we're probably going to merge with the Magellanic Clouds. We'll merge with Andromeda. You know, we'll end up as an elliptical or an S0 galaxy. So galaxy formation and evolution is an ongoing thing. And we see that in our own galaxy with the ongoing accretion of dwarf satellites. Right now, there's a dwarf satellite called the Sagittarius Dwarf, which is falling into our galaxy, being tidally torn apart, and contributing to the halo. We also suspect that there's ongoing accretion of gas going on in our galaxy. If you look at the amount of gas within the solar circle, so material inwards of the galaxy, of the sun within our galaxy, there's only enough gas inside the solar circle to power star formation for between 0.5 billion to 1 billion years. So we're going to need new fuel. And one of the things that is sort of in my theoretical prejudices coming into this problem of the high-velocity clouds is somewhere out there has to be fresh fuel for ongoing disk formation. And in order to understand the chemical properties of the disk, I think it can best be understood by constant accretion of gas. And actually, when one looks at the details, and episodic accretion of lumps of gas. Another piece of sort of theoretical prejudice coming into this is this missing baryon problem that Simon mentioned, which is, well, the baryons are supposed to be 2% of the matter, and we believe, and that number is based on the deuterium abundance and Big Bang nuclear synthesis. We look at redshift 3 or so, we can see those baryons in the line in the absorption against quasars. So we seem to see the right number of baryons out at redshift 3. But we look in the local universe at stars. You know, stars we see account for 7 × 10⁻³ of the closure density. So there's a real shortage of stuff nearby. And what I want to talk about today, and I think this talk will, well, I'm sure it will fit within the bound of having the fewest equations of a talk at ITP, since it's really going to be mostly observation. It will be an observational talk. Something called the high-velocity clouds. Now, the high-velocity clouds is something that have been known about for about 30, 40 years, but their nature really is sort of a mystery. What do we mean by high-velocity clouds? Well, most of the gas in our galaxy that is sitting in rotation in a disk in the galactic potential. So we have this thin disk of gas rotating around. We live in it and we observe it, and most of it is at relatively low velocity relative to us, since we're rotating with the disk. And this is looking out at one point in the galaxy. You point your telescope, you measure H1 emission as a function of frequency, since you're looking at the 21 centimeter line, that translates to a velocity, and this is the intensity you see as a function of position. And here's all the gas moving within the galactic disk. And out here, is a high velocity cloud. You can zoom in, and there it is. There are a whole bunch of high velocity clouds. There are a couple hundred that have been identified in the All Sky H1 surveys. And there's a couple things we know about them. Their distribution on the sky is relatively isotropic, and their kinematics are consistent with their not being part of galactic rotation. So they're not material moving with the disk, but rather material that's nearly at rest in the rest frame of the galaxy. We know they're pretty far away, at least most of them, because we can look at stars that we see in projection relative to the clouds. And with the exception of a handful of clouds I'll get to later, we generally don't see absorption to stars. So that puts a lower, we know they're at least a kiloparsec, and in some cases 2 or 3 kiloparsecs away. On the other hand, when we look at quasars, we do see these absorption lines. So a quasar that's seen through a high velocity cloud, about 40% of the time you see an absorption. The clouds are probably kind of patchy, so sometimes you happen to look through a patch that doesn't have that much in the way of metal lines to absorb the gas. With stars, people have looked at enormous numbers of stars, and with the exception of a few nearby clouds called the AC and N cloud, this is a field with, like much of astronomy, with all kinds of names, a system that was named after the, where each cloud is often named after the individual that discovers them. So they're distributed around the sky. Into, as a theorist going through the literature, it's a challenge. It's a subject that helps, I think, if you're Dutch. It's a very much a Dutch subject. They're all named after various Dutchmen. Yes. Yes. And up to about 2-3 years ago, the metallicity was, the metallicity was measured to a number of the clouds. The metallicities were always low, of order 0.1 solar, but very questionable, because they were measured in optical lines where you were very sensitive to the details of the ionization model. You're often measured in optical lines that get things that get depleted onto dust grains. So there was a lot of ambiguity in what was going on there. Some of the high-velocity clouds are, there's a general consensus on what they are. Some of them are part of what's called the Magellan Extreme, which is gas that's probably been tidally stripped out of the Magellanic clouds, and you can see them, the Magellanic Extreme, stretch across the sky. I'm going to exclude from the rest of this discussion the Magellanic Extreme. So everything I'm going to say will not include the properties of those clouds. What has been the standard model for the high-velocity clouds is something called the galactic fountain model. In the galactic fountain model, star formation in the supernova in the disk drives gas out of the disk. It has to shoot all the way up to about 10 kiloparsecs above the disk, where it cools and condenses and falls down as a rain of cold clouds. Now, you can't just kick the gas up and back, because angular momentum conservation would mean that it's still rotating the frame of the global frame. So you actually have to kick it out from the very inner 2 or 3 kiloparsecs of our galaxy, kick it out, up and over, and have the gas rain down on us. The galactic fountain model, which has been sort of the preferred model, makes a number of, I think, pretty clear predictions. The clouds should all be relatively close by, within 10 kiloparsecs. The clouds should be very metal-rich. The metallicity of gas inwards of us is above the solar metallicity, so you expect to see supersolar metallicities. A couple years ago, the paper only came out last year, and I looked to check, which surprised me. I think this, Leo Blitz and I and Butler Burton, Dob Hartman, and Peter Toibin. So revived an old model that was competing with the galactic model, which is for their origin, which is an INFOR model, that says that these clouds they're not material recycled from the galaxy, but represent material falling into the galaxy for the first time. And in particular, we focused on the idea that they were part of the whole formation, not just of our own galaxy, but of a local group. Like many ideas in astronomy, this goes back to Jan Oort. And Oort When Oort proposed it, one of the best arguments against it came from trying to estimate the distance to this galaxy, to these clouds, by assuming that they're in viral equilibrium. You measure the line width of the clouds, that then you see their angular size, you know how much hydrogen's there. You assume they're basically self-gravitating, otherwise they expand away. And that gives you a distance of 3 or 4 megaparsecs. Puts them well outside the local group, well outside the galaxy. Hard to see them as participating in infall. At those distances, you expect them to be participating in the Hubble flow, which they don't do. I think the problem with that argument was that it didn't include the possibility of dark matter. We think, you know, generally speaking, the gas is just a tracer, and that what we should have are lots of small dark matter potentials, and the gas clouds we're looking at are probably sitting in dark matter potentials. So one of the key ingredients in our picture was to say that what these high-velocity clouds represent are little dark matter halos with gas sitting in them. And these dark matter halos of gas are things falling in our galaxy and falling in on our local group. And once you buy that picture, that has a number of very interesting implications for formation history of galaxies. Because there's enough gas there for this to be the gas supply for ongoing star formation in our galaxy. It, I think, very much fits in with the basic hierarchical picture. Here are the building blocks of material falling in. With Sagittarius, we see a building block that's mostly stars falling in. And with the high-velocity clouds, we're seeing building blocks that are mostly gas. And in the last couple of years, last year or two, this model has stimulated a number of observational tests. And we've made a number of predictions, and most of them agree with the model, and one or two challenge them. And what I next want to do is say a little bit about the status of those observations. One of the, I think, most important measurements are some of the measurements of metallicity to the clouds. And recently, Bart Bakker and his collaborators were able to measure metallicity in I think it was sulfur lines, and using STIS, I think, on HST, and they found the metallicity for these clouds of 0.09 solar. And metallicity measurements on the lines of sight give higher metallicities, sometimes as large as 0.5 solar, but all the metallicities are definitely sub-solar. For me, I think this really rules out the galactic bound model. Doesn't mean that the high-velocity clouds are fitting in the details of the local group picture are right, but I see no way in which you could be kicking gas out that's primarily gas from the inner galaxy, kicked out by supernova, and have it come back down and be subsolar metallicity. Why? Because it's all supersolar gas. But then it's primarily halo gas. The 0.09, but that means most of the gas you see isn't gas from the inside. If it's been diluted to 1 to 10% solar, that means it's 10% stuff from the inner galaxy, 90% stuff from the halo. But then it's primarily local halo gas. But I think that's one important bit of new data. Another important measurement, which I think is implying that a lot of the stuff is pretty far away, comes from observations of H-alpha fluxes from the galaxy, from the high-velocity clouds. The clouds are being ionized by the metagalactic flux and also by ionizing radiation coming off the disk of our galaxy. And one of the things we predicted in our paper was that people made measurements of H-alpha that this shows the measured as of 1998, of H-alpha flux from a number of different objects. Here's the fluxes from the Magellanic Stream. Here are the fluxes from the clouds that are known to be nearby, the ACNM clouds that we know are nearby due to absorption. And in the last year, Ben Wiener and his collaborators have made measurements. This is where we predicted the fluxes should lie, all under this point, because if they're further away than 10 kpc. The ionizing, if the distance is less than 10 kpc, where you predict them to be for the galactic fountain, the gas clouds would be bombarded by ionizing flux from our galaxy. We know what those ionizing flux is. We know, I mean, this probably represents material that's been exposed to the ionizing flux from our galaxy in the Magellan Extreme. That's at a distance of 50 kpc. And this axis is nothing, but you have to plot them in subdirection, right? Otherwise, it's just a bunch of words on a line. So at 50 kpc, you expect this flux, and things that are further away than 50 kpc should lie in this direction. But things that are nearby should all really lie up here.
David, let me just add, if we just look at halo gas for a minute, one place where you can get a handle potentially on the ionized flux is 30 kilopascals.
Right.
I haven't paid attention in the last 5 years, but my memory of the carbon-4 1995 stuff that was done for looking at absorption of the halo stars was that you couldn't understand the ionization state of the gas being at 20 kilopascals.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe you can, I guess I'd like to understand the context.
Well,
you say we know it, and my memory was that we didn't know that ionizing flux at 20 or 30 kilopascals.
There's about a factor 10 uncertainty in the ionizing flux, which is going to translate to, when you look at the data, whether or not these clouds, you know, the new data, whether actually has either been upper limits or detections or for the known high, now that people have looked at high velocity clouds, all at very, very low H alpha fluxes. If you take the models with the largest ionizing flux escaping the disk, which is the stuff that Maloney and Bland Hawthorne pushed for, this puts the clouds at distances of about 200 kpc. They have to be way away from the galaxy. Any galactic flux is a real problem. If you take models in which there's more ionizing flux coming out, this gives you, I mean. Well, the Magellan Extreme gas is almost certainly being shocked. So that's going to be some of that. And the isotope, the line ratios in the Magellan Extreme gas is consistent with that. Well, if they were shocked, they'd be over here. Right? Because if you're shocking, it's just going
to.
Well, but a certain amount of flux gets out of the galaxy. If these clouds were at 5 kpc, which is where the high velocity cloud model, where this galactic fountain model predicts them to be, and you assume that 4% of the ionizing radiation gets outside the galaxy. They should be all these points should be sitting out here. Yeah, and so they're sitting about there. They'd be sitting right where ACNM are. But these guys are sitting well over from where ACNM is. I mean, they're down by a factor of 10 or so from where the ACNM clouds are. And those are the ones that are known to be nearby. I mean, this is not something where one has unambiguous distances to these things. But, you know, the galactic fountain models would say that, you know, the galactic fountain model prediction was that these clouds are just like ACNM, and we just happen not to have lines of sight that go through them. But these clouds, M is like the fifth one. These ones at about, yeah, these are about at 2 kpc. This cloud's already about 10 kpc. And there just happens to be a bright, maybe halo carbon star, so there's a bright star behind it that they got absorption lines too. But all these clouds are very low fluxes. My impression is yes, but these are unpublished data that were faxed to me this morning. So, you know, I checked this number off of our paper, but haven't sort of had time to actually go and model these fluxes. Yeah, I think all the guys up here that are against the line are upper limits. And I think these guys here are detections. What is over here? Um, Another, I think, very interesting measurement that people have made recently are measurements. This is work done by Sembach, Savage, Lew, and Murphy, where they look with GHRS, the quasars, where the high velocity cloud is sitting here. A line of sight passes within a degree of the high velocity cloud, but doesn't go through the high velocity cloud. And what they find are carbon-4 absorption lines at the same velocity, basically, within 10 kilometers a second, roughly, or so, of the high-velocity cloud. So it looks very much like ionized layers sitting around the gas cloud. And what they do is, you know, compare that to cloudy models, and it's very much consistent with sort of the picture of these clouds, sort of Ferraren field, where you've got a neutral core surrounded by an ionized layer. And this is a line of sight going through the ionized layer. And they infer for the clouds gas pressures of about 2 kelvins per centimeter cubed. And that's to be compared with disk pressures of 1,000. So very much consistent with things being at distances of about 100 kpc. You know, not at all consistent with a local, with a galactic fountain, stuff sitting down at the 0 to 10 kpc range. So those are all things that I think were very much consistent with what we said. But what I think has been, particularly for the numbers we talked about in our paper, a bit of a problem was when Swan and Briggs used the Arecibo, what they did, very nice project, where while Arecibo was being fixed, it couldn't point, so it looked just very deeply over a strip across the sky. They looked in 21 centimeter, and this strip brought you through a number of nearby groups, and they looked for clouds. And they were sensitive down to about 3 times 10 to the 7 solar masses. And they didn't find any clouds not associated with galaxies. And if we put the clouds at a distance of a megaparsec and use the, which we did when we did our analysis, the Bart Bakker's cloud catalog, then we predict, but the characteristic mass, I think we quoted, was 2 times 10 to the 7. So you should have seen something. Now, I think what may be going on, well, more recent work looking at the high-velocity cloud data, and this is some work that Leo Blitz and his student Robichaud did, is they went back to the Leiden-Dwingelow data. Leiden-Dwingelow is an all-sky, recent all-sky H1 survey. Much higher resolution than the original data that Walker used, and found that a lot of the high-velocity clouds identified in the Walker sample were actually beam smeared. So their characteristic size is about a factor two to three smaller. And if you redo the analysis that we did in our paper, but using the Leiden-Dwingelow data, we predict a characteristic mass of about 5 times 10 to the 6 solar masses, which is, you know, well below the detection limit. They're smaller, they're closer, but we just sort of scale all the numbers. So it makes the characteristic distance. Right. Right. But the velocity stays the same. Actually, the velocity numbers change a bit. The size changes. The characteristic distance comes down to about 300 kpc to half a megaparsec. And I think actually that makes it more consistent with a number of these numbers. I think the absorption line stuff actually is probably most consistent around 100 kpc, maybe 200, depending on the metallicity. You know, I think that the if I were to guess now where the distance, characteristic distances are, I'd put them, most of the clouds around 200 kpc. And there's a handful around, say, M31 that are clearly clustered around it, that are probably of order that distance from M31. There have been several sort of very recent results in this millennium that have been quite interesting on the subject, too. Blitz and Robichaud have done some nice work where they went and looked around all the known dwarf galaxies in the Leiden-Dwingelow data. People have done this before with the high-velocity clouds, but they characteristically looked right at the dwarf and said, you know, right in the center of the dwarf, is there a high-velocity cloud? The answer is generally no. But what Blitz and Robichaud found was that within 2 degrees of many of the, but roughly half, of the dwarf spheroidals in our galaxy, they found high-velocity clouds. So they look, I think they looked at the ones around our galaxy, the ones around Andromeda. In total, they looked at about, I think, 20 galaxies, saw them about half the time. By random chance, you'd expect one. What I remember is the masses for some of them. The column densities are typical of high-velocity clouds, sort of order 10 to the 18, 10 to the 19. But for some of them, the masses end up having the mass in gas to be 10 times the mass in stars in the dwarf spheroidals, dwarf irregulars, often they are. What's interesting is there's this trend that if you look at the H1 mass to star ratio, stellar mass, as a function of distance from the center of the galaxy, either our galaxy or M31, all the dwarf spheroidals within 200 kPC have very little gas. All the dwarf spheroidals outside 200 kPC, all the dwarf galaxies outside 200 kPC, have a lot of gas. And this is consistent with the fact that the stellar populations there are younger. And I think one can make a plausible story in which the gas, they're part of the high-velocity cloud story is that they're associated with dwarf galaxies. The high-velocity clouds are coming in with the dwarf galaxies. They're being ram pressure stripped at about 200 kPC. That's a pretty reasonable radius for doing ram pressure stripping. And then are destroyed. So you have gas associated with dwarfs out there. Now, I think it's a challenge to get those gas clouds around the dwarfs into them to feed them. But at least now you have gas sitting around the dwarfs that I think are a potential fuel supply for the multiple generations of star formation we see in dwarfs. And one of the very intriguing bits of HST data people have on this is you see these very number of very discrete bursts of star formation separate, you know, 1 gigayear ago and 4 gigayears ago and 10 gigayears ago. And there's a wide range of star formation history seen in the different nearby dwarfs. And the fact that you've got this H1 reservoir around might be the fuel for those different bursts of galaxy formation. Two other very interesting recent results are Kilborn has detected sort of nearby a H1 cloud with a mass just about the range we were talking about 10 to the 7 solar masses. A scale of about 15 kPC, and what they've done is they've imaged the cloud, and this particular cloud, they've got down to 27 magnitudes per square arc second in the blue band, and did not detect any galaxy. So there does seem to be some evidence growing for extragalactic clouds. And for me, with the data that I just got emailed, which I thought was really great, is stuff that comes from the high-pass survey. The high-pass survey is an H1 survey being done in Australia. This is the group, Putnam and Gibson and others, that has been able to trace out the Magellanic Stream. And they're also able to look at Sculptor. Sculptor is a nearby galaxy group. It's like our own galaxy group, as opposed to some of the ones that are more evolved, that have ellipticals in it. It's a loose group, it's a system like our own. And what they've found is a lot of H1 clouds. And this shows a plot of a scan, a range in velocity that overlaps the high velocity, that overlaps the Sculptor group. The yellow circles here are various galaxies that have been identified within Sculptor. And the blue and red things show H1 detections. We have the intensities plotted here. So a lot of some of the galaxies have much higher. So the galaxies have a lot of gas in them. But you see, in a Sculptor group, a lot of small little clouds of gas, very much like the picture that we've been promoting for the local, for our own local group, where we have clouds of gas sitting here. Now, no one yet has gone and sat and imaged these things deeply to see if there's a low surface brightness galaxy here. But I think that'll be interesting either way, whether there may be a low surface brightness galaxy sitting here or not. I think it's plausible to posit a picture in which you've got these dark halos of 10, 20 kilometers a second. The gas sits in them. Sometimes the conditions are such that you can form stars. You get a dwarf spheroidal. And sometimes you don't. The H1 column is 10 to the 18, 10 to the 19. I think the masses are of order 10 to the a few 10 to the 6. For these guys here. And there's a lot of them. This is just one slice in velocity space. And here's another slice. Or again, here's some of the ones that are identified with galaxies. And there's a whole bunch that are just sitting out there that look like to be gas detections. So there does seem to be a reservoir of gas outside of galaxies. And I think it's reasonable to be supposing that these clouds are coming in. That I think one can think about fitting in these nearby clouds, these AC and M clouds in these pictures, as they represent clouds and material that has actually fallen all the way in. And probably some of it has gotten ram pressure stripped from the dark matter. And this is the fuel that will power future star formation. I think we turn around and look at what that would imply for the chemical evolution of our galaxy. It's consistent with a number of observations. This episodic accretion of gas would give rise to things like drops in the metallicity of the gas of our own galaxy. Like when the sun formed, the metallicity of the gas was about the solar level. Well, somehow, Orion has managed to get down to half solar. And, you know, so you've got this big cloud of gas at lower metallicity.
But the sun's not suitable for our solar radius.
It's on the high side, but Orion's on the rather on the low side. And if you have a closed box model for chemical evolution, the metallicity should be going up with time. And if you look at the metallicity of the correlations between oxygen to iron versus iron to hydrogen, you see a very, very tight correlation in nearby stars. But you see a lot of scatter between iron Fe to H versus Strongman ages. And based on that, Edvardsen and collaborators, and who really have, I think, the best stellar data at the moment, argued there must be some episodic accretion, and episodic accretion with very little mixing. And that's, I think, very consistent with this picture, in which you don't have a galactic fountain operating on large scales. You know, galactic fountain means lots of mixing. The metals are coming all the way in and up. You expect to have pretty homogeneous metallicity through the galaxy. And this picture in which you have accumulating a cloud here, mixing is relatively inefficient. The fountain, to the extent it is operating very locally. Intriguingly, one of the things we found when we looked at the Leiden-Dwingelow data in some detail is there actually is a net tendency for the H1 to be falling, coming into the plane. There's more gas, more neutral gas coming in than going out. So there does appear to be a galactic fountain operating, but it's operating on velocities of 5 kilometers a second and very small local scale rather than on a global scale. Yeah? Well, there's a couple possibilities. One possibility is that some of the clouds have some stars associated with them. But this is this was the general problem. We're talking about a coffee. Whether or not these clouds are not local or nearby or far away, we know that there are clouds in Lyman Alpha Forest that are, the debate is 100 kiloparsecs or megaparsec away from a typical galaxy, but at those distances, that have metals at redshift of 3. So somehow metals got out. And, Coffee was lots of different ideas on how to get the metals out, but it's tied into, I think, this very interesting problem for galaxy evolution in general. And I think one could, if we can lucky enough to get a very bright quasar behind one of these high-velocity clouds, then it'd be interesting to get some, say, deuterium abundances to see if we're seeing stuff that's been polluted or stuff that's been locally processed and enriched, get more detailed chemical measurements. One of the things that would be very nice to know, the standard story of high-velocity clouds has been in the past, these are gas clouds that don't have stars associated with them. And that's because people were looking with the idea in mind that they were a kiloparsec away. So they were looking for pretty bright stars. Now that they seem to be further away, you know, there may be more galaxies associated with them. You know, Mario Mateo would argue that most of the dwarfs in our galaxy have been found, and that we, you know, we've done the full counting. And I think Julianne would say, no way. Mario said that in an reviews paper. That's what he says. He, you know, he wrote the definitive review. That's what he said. He argued that the incompleteness was small. He basically said there's a handful of dwarfs left, there's a handful of things left to be discovered, but we know the local group. He talked about 90-80% completeness. Well, that's how they're defined, is these 21-centimeter detections. This GHRS work is quite an interesting way of finding another kind of high-velocity clouds. And they've identified a number of these things. We look at a quasar absorption line, and you see these clouds at these velocity ranges, but now you're seeing them in these ionized states. You know? And with STIS up on HST, I know that this group and other groups are going to be doing other Mendelssohn measurements, other absorption line studies. So I think, this subject is now moving pretty quickly with the data. In 2 or 3 years, I think we should have a number of Mendelssohn measurements. Ben Wiener is continuing his program, I believe, of H-alpha measurements. We should have this high-pass map of sculptors. Great, he's got, you know, this is all unpublished data. That through the wonders of electronic, you know, once you email it to one person, it just gets around. That should be very interesting. I know Julianne and one of her students are going to be looking in Sloan for these high velocity clouds and see if they can identify galaxies with them. So I think we may have a much more coherent story. And I think it's a story that's important not just for understanding what these objects are, but I think in tying into our whole picture of galaxy formation.
So on that note, people like PhD, who have done some work in terms of some of the work with spending cold clouds, that might have heard, concerned about it because the process is like echoing everything. Do you have any comments on that?
Well, this is one, I think, to me, for the galaxy formation problem, one of the most interesting problems, right? To put it in a broader context, if you take the most naive model of how to form a galactic disk, and you say, well, all that matters for a dark matter halo is its mass and its angular momentum. And let the gas, put the gas in solid body rotation, because it was externally tidally torqued from other things around, let it collapse and cool, it forms a very nice galactic disk. This is something that goes back some way to Mistel, and Simon and his collaborators, and Julian and I have looked into, and among other people. And you fit lots of properties of this. You get fit the Tully-Fisher relation, exponential disks, all sorts of things. The problem is when you try to do it in detail, right? Collapse, galaxy formation is not this monolithic collapse with cool condensation, but all these lumps falling in. When all these lumps fall in, the lumps tend to transfer a lot of angular momentum from the gas and the dark matter to the halo. And it's not clear, I think, what the solution is. Some kind of energy injection, maybe. Maybe the fact that, you know, what you need to do is stop the gas from cooling. And stop it from, the kind of gas clouds we see in these high velocity, if all inflowing systems look like these dwarf spheroidals, where you have the stars in the center and the gas way outside sitting out there, that'd be great. That's just, you know, now, it'll be fine, yeah. It's the big things, yeah. It's, you know, it's sort of the Magellanic extreme, Magellanic clouds coming in. So the LMC is going to come in, and it's going to leave all its dark matter out there, right, and bring the baryons all the way in. Isn't that? I mean, that's the stuff that's the culprit. Is that right?
How does the planet bucket work out? In other words, if you're going to keep star formation going in the galaxy in 31 or another, you know, 3 times 10 to the 9 years, you're going to be well over 10 to the 10 solar mass. About the 10 to the synthesis because of the 70?
It's if the, yeah, you need a solar mass a year, so you need about not another t- you know a few times 10 to the 9 to keep it going for a while. There are 1,000 clouds known in the local group. Mass range is a few times 10 to the 6. So it's about right, and that's just the H1 mass. But probably, I mean, something about it, but it's consistent. There's more ionized mass around it, and I think from these carbon line studies, I think this inside-out picture of neutral gas on the inside, ionized gas on the outside seems to fit. See, the characters within the local group, the amount of mass is 4 or 5 times 10 to the 9 in H1, that range. Is it so? Prime 4 to 10 to the 9. But it's comparable to the mass of H1 in the galactic disk. It's the same. It doubles the amount of gas available. This may supply us with enough fuel for star formation for another billion years, or maybe 2 billion years if you assume there's an ionized component around it. But this isn't all. This is not where all the missing baryons are. Though I'm not sure how much you can hide in ionizing clouds, ionizing layers around it. Probably not. Right. Yep. Well, they may be the tracers of it. I mean, what may be going on is you've got material falling in filaments. These are dwarf halos sitting in the filaments, 10 kilometers, and there's gas sitting in the halos where these halos are deep enough to condense. There's other gas probably sitting in the filaments that's not collapsed down to the halos, that's intermediate, that's at, 10 to the 5K. Not with the mass. I mean, there's these oxygen 6 results that were just reported where they saw oxygen 6 in absorption. And I don't know what gas densities are there. All I've seen was the AAS press release. I didn't go to the talk, so I just know what I read in the New York Times. Did anyone hear the oxygen 6 results? But was that, yeah. Rotationally. I think you should be able to see it. I mean, what you tend to find, Arif and I did this with Jeremy Kepner. We just put a dark halo, put the gas in, and you get these dense, very dense cores in the center. And observationally, you do see dense cores. But what worries me a little bit is you see not one dense core, but often a couple dense cores. Now, if these represent little clouds and filaments, maybe that's what's going on. But I also suspect, I mean, one of the things we certainly didn't have in our treatment was the feedback from star formation. And if a lot of these things, if we see dwarfs here, so maybe these things are going through cycles where, certainly, we had to stop a code at some point when we put an extra cooling, right, because you actually do get you get H2 formation at some point, and do get cooling and perhaps star formation. Yeah. Right, but the current data on the coal-dust cross-correlations, what they say is that the clouds are further away than... if they have dust, they're further away than 10 kPc. So, that which is not constraining here. I think it's a constraint on the galactic fountain model if you want to say that the reason you saw low metallicity was in dust. And that's Bakker and Boulanger, I think, did that work. Yeah. I mean, one can probably do a better job of that now with SCUBA or one of the many things I tried to nudge Dave Schlegel to do, take his dust maps, and I suspect one would do a better correlation with the high velocity clouds there. Well, great. Yep. Well, Blitz and Robichaud again, or another one of the students at Berkeley, has gone and looked at a couple of these in the Palomar plates, and they see smudges. And then. Well, there's a class, there are people who could look at Palomar plates and find galaxies, and they seem to succeed, which when you go back and look, they're there. There are talents that I couldn't do, but and they find these things, and Raja and Guhapatra and Leo Blitz, I know, are going to look with Keck and image them and get distances, so see if these are stars there. So I think that there's some really some clear things to do to see what's going on here, and it's I think interesting for understanding what these things are. But I think they also give us a hint for some of the things that's going on in galaxy formation. I mean, I should have brought with me, but it's in the AstroPH paper, some of the the Litz and Robichaud stuff where they've got these H1 clouds, the high velocity clouds sitting outside the dwarfs. I mean, to sort of sketch it, you've got it's really a thing. Well. You've got the dwarf here, and you've got gas clouds here and here. And they're surrounded in velocity. And the separation here is of order a degree. And the distances for dwarfs, if you say, 200 kpc, means these things are 2-3 kpc out. So you're sitting pretty far outside the dwarf, the stellar part of the dwarf. So they seem to be extended. And, maybe this is the answer to some of the accretion problems. Somehow we can get a lot of the gas hanging around, but not sitting in the center of the potential. You may have this cycle where you ionize the gas. You have star formation. It ionizes the gas. It keeps in the ionized state for a while. You lose your massive stars, the ionizing flux drops, and you didn't let the gas form again. Right. No, but I think they have to be stable on dynamical time. The dynamical times out there are very short, so these aren't things that are sort of temporary things expanding outwards. But I think on the Hubble time, absolutely.
But it seems like the stars will basically.
Yeah. Well, I think.
So the question is, at what level are you shocked?
I mean, if it's 200, Yeah. So I think this is a problem that we'll solve itself. But if these gas clouds are 200 kpc. This is a very different picture from the galactic fountain,
right,
which is the standard picture for what's going on here. Yeah. And if they do all have stars, it means that the dwarf spheroidal population is huge. There's 1,000 of these high velocity clouds, and that then there's this. Yeah. Stop there.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.